Welcome to the Sensei Playbook, the ultimate podcast for the automotive industry. Each week, we dive into the success stories and best practices from industry leaders who put customer experience first. From driving repeat business to earning coveted referrals, discover the tools and tactics that set the best apart. Get ready to hit the road to success. This is the Sensei Playbook.
Welcome back to this week's episode of the Sensei Playbook. Today we have a special guest and longtime client of Reputation Sensei, Duke Brubaker from Champion Ford in Owensburg, Kentucky. Welcome, Duke. Looking forward to our conversation today.
While I was in college, I tried to sell cars at a standalone used car lot that was a friend of the family. And back in the early 90s, there really wasn't the CAC or special finance. So I'd sell 10 cars, and of 10, two would stick. So that really frustrated me when I went back to college after working 3 months over the summer, and my roommate and best friend was flipping pizzas on the Jersey Shore. He'd make three times as much money as I did and tell me all of his escapades of working on the Jersey Shore. I sweated on the pavement all summer and made a fraction of what he made. When I graduated college, my father was like, "We need to come work for me at the Ford store." And I was like, "No, I tried those car sales and wasn't a fan." But he said, "Selling for a franchise dealer is a little bit different than an independent." In the 90s, it sure was. And so we had a guy that was my age actually call me and recruit me. And I was able to come to Owensboro. I'd never lived here before. My family grew up all over the place. My dad was an old retired baseball player. So at that time, when I was really, really young, I moved all over the place and in Evansville, Indiana, and then transferred to Lexington as he ran a store there, graduated from high school there, and then went away to school in Virginia. So a little bit of a mixed bag of history there.
Wow. So who do you play ball for?
My father played for the Braves. His rookie card was with the Detroit Tigers. Back then, it was the Milwaukee Braves, not the Atlanta Braves. Okay. And he shares a Detroit Tiger rookie card with Bill Roman. He gets fan mail here all the time at the dealership. I pile it all up and then get it to him to sign. He has actually one of the top 10 or top 20 most unique baseball cards, according to either ESPN or I forget who the ranking was, SportsCenter, with his Dodgers, 1967 Dodgers cards, which you can go to eBay and search Bruce Brubaker Dodgers, and you'll see the card is wearing his Dodger blue with a big red, the lapels coming underneath the jersey. Actually, I have a card right here. Yeah, there it is.
Exactly.
See the big lapels? He signed this.
Wow.
That's awesome.
I'm supposed to know. So he got into the car business back in the early 70s when he tore his rotator cuff pitching, and back then there was no surgery to fix that. And in the winter ball, he'd play winter ball in the winter, go down to Dominican and San Juan is where he met my mother, imported her back home away from her family. So it showed that he was a pretty good salesman to bring my mother out of the country and back home here. They got married in 68, and he decided he wanted to get into car sales. He started selling cars in the early 70s and then transitioned all the way up to a dealer, bought a Champion Ford with some partners back in 1990.
Why is that you see athletes when they retire or something happens, like the automotive industry seems like a natural segue for a lot of athletes. Do you have any insight into why that is?
Well, I think it's the concept that most athletes are internally driven to succeed, and they've really pushed themselves hard physically, mentally, emotionally. He was a baseball player, and that is a game of failure. You know, the best hitter in the world hit 406, 400. Is this time the hitter is really good. That means you fail 70% of the time. So those guys know how to drive themselves, know how to push themselves, moving themselves into a business that does that and it helps you succeed. And they can build a team. They're used to working in a team atmosphere. And to run a successful car dealership, you have to have a really good team around you. You trust and you can lean on and you can help you move the envelope. So I think that's the easy transition for athletes to get into this business.
So what's your father doing now? Just enjoying retired life, or?
Yeah, oh, he's not retired. He's still a VP here, and he's around, and his office is right next door. And yeah, he definitely is involved still.
I remember Hank Aaron had the BMW store here for a while. Now Sons BMW of South Atlanta, BMW of South Atlanta, which is a client. But yeah, Hank Aaron had that store after his career.
Yeah, there's a picture downstairs of the 1965 Braves and my father standing right next to old Henry. He calls it Henry, and Henry was a heck of a player and a heck of a great guy. They talked often.
How did you two meet? Give me the lowdown.
I don't know if we can tell that story, can we, dude?
Well.
That's a good one. No, we won't tell that story.
You don't want to tell that story? Not yet? You want to wait a little bit?
When we first started, so Aaron, who's still with us to this day, had just started with another gentleman. We brought two SDRs in, and they were tasked with calling dealers. And I think our script at the time was, hey, we've got, you know, some leads for you in the form of referrals. And Duke's store informed one of our SDRs, and his name was Michael. And they were 2 weeks on the job. They were brand new. And let me just go back and say this about Michael, the one that called Duke's store. This guy walked in. He was just a ray of sunshine. Walked in with a huge smile on his face every day. Bright, positive, I mean, just super, super energetic African-American guy, about 6'2", just well-built and just smiling from ear to ear. And so he called Duke's store and went through the script. And evidently, I guess the receptionist, Duke, correct me if I'm wrong, said, hey, we're not interested.
He got the F&I manager, so he got all the way up the ladder a little bit, yeah.
Okay, so he did get through to someone. Okay, so F&I.
You know, F&I manager's normally pretty busy, and finally she just – probably rudely shut him down and said, no, we're out. Leave me alone.
Yeah, we're not interested. Mm-hmm. At which point our SDR went online and wrote was it a DealerRater?
I don't remember. It was Google.
DealerRater. You got informed before it went public. And so Duke gets – anyway, we get a phone call. We get a phone call after hours from Duke, and he's like, who is this? And we're like, well, this is Reputation Sensei. And he goes, okay. And my partner was like, who's this? And Duke said, you'll find out, and hung up and then called back. And said, one of your people called our store today and offered us your services, and we politely declined and said we weren't interested, at which point your employee went online and wrote a DealerRater review saying that we were racist. And I said, and so my partner's calling me, telling me this. I'm sitting in the gym. I'm sitting in Lifetime's parking lot. I'm going, there's no way. This is not – I know the two guys that were making the phone calls. I said, Mark was my partner at the time. And I said, Mark, go in there, look at his computer and investigate this. So he goes on and looks at the guy's computer and finds he had went on and created a DealerRater. You got to create a DealerRater account to write a review. And he wrote, these people don't want were racist and didn't want our services. And so we were like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? So we called Duke. We said, Duke, we're going to take care of this. No problem. We pulled the guy in the next day, and, you know, he was 2 weeks on the job, and we said, what were you thinking? And he goes, oh, I didn't know that they would see it. We were like, what? You wrote a review. What do you mean you didn't mean they were going to see it? And so we had to let him go. And it was funny. We terminated him, of course, and we were talking to Duke that day. And Duke was like, well, I hate that he had to get fired. And we were like, no, Duke. you felt bad for the guy. You said yeah. You literally said, I've had salespeople do stupid shit before. And we said, no, man, that's a huge liability. So if he'll do that, what else would he would do? I mean, so that's how we met Duke. And as we were talking to Duke that day, still doing damage control, my director of business development, Kerry Greenberg, was literally trying to sell Duke on our services. And I was like, too soon, man, stop.
Oh, my God.
But about 2 months later, I think we actually did a demo, and Duke signed up, and you've been a client ever since.
Yeah, it's been a while ago, and I still operate the same way I did back then. I saw that review because I personally answer every single one of them. I have a service like you all to help me obtain the review to get the word out there. Hey, please fill out a review. It's important. But when that comes back, I don't hire anybody to fill out anything. I don't use AI to fill out the response for me. So when I get those responses, I take them to heart because either one of my people screwed up, needs training, or we need to fix a situation, or I need to give my salesperson a pat on the back or a tech or somebody that did a good job. So I answer every single one of them, and I have for years. So if you go back to Google, you go back to Facebook, DealerRater, you see my name signed it. I sat down on my phone or my computer, and I actually answered that review. So I saw that review come back pretty quick, and I had to go answer who went around to the store. Who dealt with this person? And finally got to F&I, and she told that he was selling something, and that's how I tracked you down.
I saw that you, even going back to 2014, you were personally responding to all the reviews that came in. And I guess, why do you think it's important that you are the one that does that?
Well, I mean, you know, we're in a town that's not a small town, but it's relatively big, and I've got two young boys in town, and they're active in sports, and our family's here. We've lived here since 1990, and when I go out, you know, if I go down to the River Park or to the Friday After Five concert, I normally leave right from work, and a lot of times I'm wearing our logo proudly, and I tell our people to wear our logo proudly, and I'm not ashamed to go anywhere, go to the grocery store, go everywhere. If I run into somebody, I don't want them to be unhappy with our dealership or me, and some people get pretty personal when it comes to their car. And when it breaks or something happens, they're not very happy, and I want to try to fix the situation. Some you just can't fix. It just happens. It's important for me to know every single review that comes in, why they're upset, did we do something wrong, can they be salvaged, can they be fixed? And if they can't, I just opt to respond, I'm sorry, this is our position, and I disagree, and we'll have to move on.
You get a chance to know your customers even better as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've got some, you know, a few one-star reviews on there that we can't delete a review. A lot of customers think we can go on Google and delete a one-star review. That's not possible, and maybe people should be educated to that. And I recently heard a metric that one one-star Google review equals 30 five-star reviews. They have that weight to it. And if that's the case, that's extremely unfair from Google's perspective. But I did read that online. And of course, it's true if it's online, right? So it's very important that those one-star reviews I respond to. A lot of times I'm on the phone with them. And unfortunately, sometimes you get a review in and you can't verify their name because it's set up an ID with Google that you can't understand who it is. And I invite them to call me or email me or something and communicate back so I can help them. I never hear anything back from them. So it's unfortunate that I can't help everybody that's unhappy. But luckily, we don't have too many. We have a very good rating. And it's important to me and our staff that everybody communicates with our customers that are not happy. And the ones that are happy, we appreciate them. We let them know, and thanks for the review. Google will only let you write one. So unfortunately, as repeat customers come back, I've seen the last few months, we've sold some repeat customers. And I'll go in to respond to it, and I saw I responded to it 3 years ago. So the new review says today, and then my response says 4 years ago. So I'm like, oh, this is a repeat customer, so I have to update it. And then hit thank them again or something.
I love the fact that you get involved with the feedback loop, because there's two sides to online reputation. There's the public facing, and then there's that feedback loop that really helps put you in touch with your true customer journey. And you really get involved with that and use the feedback, because quite frankly, we have clients that just have that public facing front, and then ones that really use that feedback to get better. So I love the fact that you're really rolling up your sleeves and getting involved in that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of dealers, maybe the bigger ones and some of the really small ones, they really just don't care. They don't look at it. They don't look at reputation management. And you need to, because, you know, people, when I'm going to buy something, I'll look. And, of course, you look at the most recent ones, and then you immediately click one star. And you look at the one-star reviews, and why are these one stars on this product, this service, whatever it is? I want to read what they're saying. And are they recent? Are they one stars from 6 years ago? Are they one stars all from the last 4 months? And then did they respond to the one star? How did they respond? So, and I'm a consumer. That's exactly what I look at. So I know, you know, what my consumers are looking at when they get in there. I don't have many one stars, number one. And when they get in there, look at them, hopefully they see my response. Sometimes I'm not too nice in my responses. I mean, you can't be. Sometimes customers are wrong. Sometimes they bought a $3,000 car. They knew it was as is. They knew it was a 200,000-mile car, and then it breaks in a month. Well, I'm sorry. You bought a $3,000 car. I have to say that on the response. You knew it was as is. We had you sign 3 as-is forms, and it broke. Hey, sorry.
The customer isn't always right.
Not 100%. We try to take that to heart, but, you know, when they're wrong, and I respond to those one-star reviews, I try to do it honestly and tell them, look, I will try to help you out. We'll trade you out of something. And it's a service issue. We'll try to get it fixed. You know, the last few years, we've dealt with a lot of, you hear about supply chain. You know, I had an Expedition transmission that was, it took 6 to 8 months for it to come in. And the vehicle's just parked out back. And they're still building those vehicles. So it's like, why can't you just take one off the line and ship it to us? That's not how it works.
Right.
So yeah, the customers are pretty understanding about that. And they know that it's not our fault necessarily on that. But, you know, either in today's society, you're either a one star or a five star. I rarely see 3, 4 star. I got a 4-star last week, and I was like, wow, a 4-star. That's crazy. But that's that person that nobody's perfect, you know.
The person that had a tough, strict parent or tough teachers, that, and then
Rarely see 2 and 3 stars. you know, two stars is like a unicorn. You never see those.
And I'd love to get your take on this, that customer behavior has evolved pretty dramatically in the last, let's say 7 to 10 years, where if somebody wanted to learn about a car, there were way fewer sources of information for them to tap into prior to coming to a dealership and checking the car out. Whereas now I can do a ton of research. There's a million sources of information I can tap into to do a ton of research prior to even reaching out to the dealer. And that probably 90-something% of that buying process is done outside of talking to somebody at your dealership and maybe beforehand. And I'd love to get your take on how you've seen customer behavior evolve and sort of how you're meeting people where they are.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. When I get to work in the morning, one of the first things I do every single day is I look at my metrics and look at the top 10 most clicked cars last night. And I look at those and I say, okay, these are the top 10 vehicles people are clicking on. And I look at those, and if a couple of them are aged, you know, I know, okay, this car's ready to move. And then sometimes I give them a little nudge. I say, okay, this one's been clicked 180 times last night by 70 unique users. Maybe I should reduce that about $400 or $500. And if it's aged, you know, try to push it out. And then do that, and it works. If it's a fresh car, and I see it's all of a sudden blowing out the metrics, so I know we're underpriced, and I raise the price, and I get people calling, hey, can I get that old price that I saw yesterday? Sure, come on in. Let's buy it. Let's go. It's something we look at every single day. Everybody uses pricing software anymore, so you're not going to be – if you're a wise dealer who knows what they're doing, you use pricing software, and you're not going to be $4,000 and $5,000 out of market. Everybody uses the MVP price. We've been advertising MVP price for 10 years now, the market value price, and you know, that's something we do, and if you put that online and you're priced right, then the customers come in, then you tell them the value story, and then you tell them, hey, we care about your business. We have the signs up all over for your reviews. We're not hiding anything. And I tell the salespeople, make an evidence manual, show them why they should buy from you, because people at the end of the day buy from somebody they like. They come in here, they might love that vehicle, they might love the price. If your salesperson's a jerk or not personable and makes them mad, you're going to leave. That's the end of the story. They're going to leave, and they probably get a review that you didn't sell. And you get a few of those people who didn't sell, not recently, but you know, a few years back. So that's important, too, to watch that and know. It gives you a sense on how your customers are feeling and what they're looking at when they come on the lot, because traffic has diminished, but the closing ratios have gone up. So back in the day, you'd get 10 ups. Say you got 10 ups in a day, and then you sell 20%, you'd sell 2. Now you get 10 ups in a week, you might sell 5, you know, something like that. So those numbers are way out. But, you know, the closing ratios have gone up, and people do know what they're looking for when they step on the lot. A lot of times they know that car maybe sometimes better than the salesperson is showing it to them. So you better be honest when you're showing a vehicle, because a lot of times they've done their research, and you can turn a customer off by telling them this truth real fast.
I think that's genius, looking at the clicks. I had not heard that before, and I think that is a really interesting insight. Do you have anything else like that your morning routine?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I look at my other screen over here. I look at how many total sessions I had on our website and our average sessions per day. And, you know, it's down 1.2% over last month. Well, you know, my average engagement time is 1:45 on our website. I compare it to my 20 group, and they're at 1:30. So I know I'm on par. I'm doing a little bit better. Our engagement rate's 76% compared to 69%. But they're getting more traffic. We don't do any paid search here. Most of the other stores in my 20 group do a lot of paid search. That's something that's very expensive. And we try to do some other things to advertise our vehicles, and don't want to give out all the secret sauce, but you know, we try to spend our money wisely, because sometimes those paid search companies will sell you all the low-hanging fruit, a lot of money, 20-25% commission on that. So I try to focus on my market area. I don't really focus on areas that are 4 and 5 hours away. I know Auto Trader's been selling a product where I can market my products to other cities, and it'll look like I'm a local dealer. So if I wanted to all of a sudden look like I'm a local Nashville dealer, I can do that by paying them more money. You know, you might get some BDPs, you might get a lot of leads coming in, but then do they actually show up at the store? That's important. So when I watch the clicks, I want to make sure they're local, they're quality, and that's what I think one reason why our engagement rate's higher than my 20 group, because I do spend more time and effort on my local market area. That's the most important to me, I want to sell a customer that comes back for service, that comes back to see us, and I might see at the grocery store, and hey, I'll tell you about that salesperson at your dealership. They were awesome, and I appreciate the way I was treated. And I get a lot of that, which is great.
What's your opinion of some traffic attribution tools like Clairvoy?
I'm not familiar with that one.
They track traffic to your website from third-party sources. Yeah.
Probably similar to what we use, Foundation Direct. Foundation Direct is hooked up with our 20 group, which is NCM. And so they hooked up a bunch of the dealers in the 20 group. So when I look at the Foundation Direct numbers, it actually compares it to all the dealers in my 20 group. So I can see it helps me quantify what my number is. Because if I say I've got 322 average sessions to my site per day, is that good or is that bad? I don't know. But when I look over here to the right and I see my 20 group average is 450 nights, well, I'm 130 light of that. But, you know, I've got dealers in Michigan, Detroit, Sarasota, Florida. So I've got some pretty large dealers in my group. So if I can get close to that average session, then I'm happy.
That's interesting. You're able to get benchmarks from the other people in the 20 group. That makes all the difference, knowing.
Yeah, benchmarks are so important because you can look at that and you can absolutely see if I'm really good at something or if I'm not. You know, otherwise that data is useless if you can't compare it to something.
What are you optimizing? Like, what KPIs are you really optimizing for? Is it people in the door, or is it more, is it something further down the funnel?
Well, yeah, people in the door ultimately is what you're looking for. So I mean, I can get all the clicks per day and I can get all the VDP views per day, but if it doesn't transition to somebody walking on the lot or picking up the phone and calling, then it's useless. So we want to make sure that we get them here. We do have a photo booth for our vehicles, so we take pictures of all the used vehicles to make sure that they're quality pictures. We don't hide anything. We use a nice SLR camera. We have lighting above, and we take quite a few pictures of that vehicle. So when the customer comes here, they're not surprised on the vehicle quality and say, well, I saw these pictures online. You see some dealers that will, you know, pick four or five pictures and throw it up there. And we try to make sure we put our best foot forward online. When they get here, they're not surprised, and we lose the deal.
What's your number one in the customer buying process today?
Gosh, I'd say time maybe. We're trying to speed everything up. We know that since COVID, time is more valuable than ever. People are used to that instant gratification. They want something quick and easy. We did have, you know, when COVID hit, we did have all the buying situations on our website where you can go on there and you can actually buy a car on our website. And it seems like Ford and a lot of manufacturers are pushing towards that. Customers are pushing back, though. They're not really going down that road. They don't want to completely, maybe a few percent, I'd say less than 5%, because we didn't see any. The whole six-month period where we went from shut down completely in the sales department to open minimally in Kentucky, the governor shut us down for a while in sales. We weren't necessary, or what they call it, I forget, whatever they called those workers. The service was, because if your car broke, you need to get to work. So they were open, but sales was shut down for a while. So we just make sure that those metrics are important to us.
Digital retailing, that's the process online that's supposed to speed up the process.
And what we found out, we use different people from Goobagoo to AutoFi, and there's a bunch of digital retailers out there that will sell you their product. The customers will do that, and then they'll stop. And then it becomes a lead. So it's just another lead source. It's something, you know, Lincoln was really pushing towards digital retailing. They wanted us to sell the customer at home. They wanted to deliver the vehicle at home. They wanted us to service the customer at home, mobile service vans and all that. And they want us to build a new facility. Okay, so you want them to buy from home. You want them to pick up and deliver their car. You want them to do the mobile service with the mobile service van, and you need a new facility. Why? It makes no sense. So sometimes the people up in Detroit don't understand what it takes to sell a car and what we have to do daily. And maybe they should come and spend some time at the dealerships and learn that. Because, you know, why spend $8 million on a brand new facility? Everything you're doing is telling them to stay at home and buy the car. And they're still doing that. You know, they're still pushing buying from home and they want to lower the transaction time. Everybody's modeling Tesla. Tesla's got, they say you can buy, in our last board meeting, they showed us you can buy a car on Tesla's website in less than 3 minutes. That was their benchmark. Well, that's great for a Tesla customer, but, you know, my average F-150 customer doesn't want to do that. And F-150 is our number one selling vehicle. The Super Duty customer doesn't want to buy from home. He wants to come in, drive the truck, look at the truck, talk to a salesman who's knowledgeable about the truck, and then talk to us F&I person in person. We've got a lot of farmers, a lot of business people that want to come here. They don't want to buy an $80,000 to $100,000 vehicle online. maybe a Tesla customer does, but that's a different person. It's a completely different person.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know anybody that drives a Tesla. So.
Yeah, that's fine for Tesla, but you know, my guy is not there yet.
Jesse drives a Tesla. I went and drove one, and I was kind of turned off from the experience because I'm the guy who wants the salesman to explain everything. I want you to be in that car on that test drive with me. When I went to test drive a Tesla for my fiance, the guy literally spent about 10 minutes with us in the showroom, took us out to the car, put us in the car, stuck his head in the driver's side window, gave me a 5-minute tutorial on the car, and then sent me on my way. And I drove, and I was like, wow, it's fast, right? It's fast. And I didn't know how anything worked on the car. And I came back, and we didn't buy it. We ended up buying an Infiniti for it. But I want, what we really practice in our training with, you know, our dealer clients is immersive test drives. Really, you want to really don't skip the product demonstration. It's so important. Unless the person walks in, like you said, and knows more about the car than the salesman. And that happens with them.
Oh, that definitely happens with Tesla customers, I would imagine. Yeah. We traded for a few of them. And you know, I can't imagine demoing one of those vehicles brand new without somebody with me. It's just the starting process alone is completely different. It's unbelievable that he wants to do that and has done that, I guess, successfully without dealerships. And I would think that he would have quite a bit more market share if he had dealerships in the country to push those, because it's a phenomenal product. It's unlike anything on the market until recently. Now we've got electric cars. He's got a lot of stuff coming at him. And, you know, they aren't for everybody, but they're definitely dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, I would never buy another one again because of the way he depreciated it after I bought it. There are probably four.
Hey, they only care about selling those new ones. And, you know, he all of a sudden makes the window sticker $20,000 less. That just
like 3 days after I buy the car. And I'm thinking, like, what a crappy move for your customers.
Who, it was 100% his fault, though. The government came out with that tax thing, and then they put those benchmarks in there on the cap and the ceiling on what it had to be. You know, for a truck, it was $80,000. And all of a sudden, the vehicles to qualify for trucks had to be under $80,000. Well, Ford did the same thing. All of a sudden, Lightnings lowered $8,000, $9,000. You know, they were less money to qualify for that benchmark. And I think some one of them was maybe $60,000. I forget what the other ones were for cars. But the manufacturers play the game with the government. They're all toying with our money. It's our tax money. Just let the market win. Let the market lose. They're pushing people into these EVs by using my tax dollars. And I've got a few Lightnings on the ground now. And in Western Kentucky, they're a tough sell. Fantastic product. It's an unbelievable truck. It's fun to drive. It's fast. It's quiet. Technology is awesome. But we're having a tough time selling in Western Kentucky.
Is it the premium that they cost, or is it just basically the lack of infrastructure?
You know, maybe a little bit of both. I mean, they were expensive, but, you know, since they did the tax thing, they lowered it to $80,000. The truck is now 79,000 MSRP. Right now, with the federal government and our discount, we're advertising those at $10,000 off sticker. If you're talking about 69,000 MSRP or sale price. And then Ford just came out with 0% for 60 months off. Zero for 60, $10,000 off, and I still haven't worked a deal on one. In what's today, the 30th, the 29th? I haven't worked a deal on one in 29 days. So do they need to do 15,000 off sticker? Or sticker is invoice with these things. It's stupid. But if I need to be 15,000 off invoice and offer 0%, there used to be a $7,500 Ford rebate. When they came with the 0 for 60, they took that rebate away. So now it's just all, you know, our commission. So basically we're giving up our commission to sell these vehicles and just get them off our lot.
Stop production on the Lightning?
No, they're still making them. They're shipping 24s. These are 23s I'm talking about. So it's almost June. I've got new 23s on the ground.
But it's a complete EV. It's not hybrid,
right? Yeah. Lightning's 100% EV. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, can you still get a Lightning and a gasoline?
No. Lightnings are 100% EV. Yeah.
Wow.
We have a hybrid. We have a Power Boost hybrid F-150. Okay. You don't have to plug that one in.
How are those doing?
Doing better. I mean, the customer needs to be educated on them. They're a little afraid of them. But if I was going to buy an F-150, that's 100% the way I'd buy it. You fill it up. You know, you got 750-mile range. That's pretty good. You can drive from here to Destin. I won't take a gas, but I'd have to stop and use the restroom.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
What would you say is the key to a successful test drive? Just getting in the head of a salesperson there. Like, what makes a successful tester?
You know, we've trained forever. We probably need to get back to this. You know, as we've probably learned some bad habits over the COVID era, people just coming in and buying. A successful test drive is first and foremost a good product presentation before the customer leaves. Know the features of the vehicle, know what they're getting into, and then getting the customer comfortable behind the wheel. Going on a routine, a planned route. It can't be a different route every time. It needs to be a planned route. Hopefully, mostly right-hand turns that are safer than crossing traffic. And then knowing out with the customer and then being quiet. Let the customer enjoy the vehicle and let the customer know, hey, I'm just going to sit here and let you look around, drive the car. If you have any questions, let me know. You don't want to go on a test drive and talk the entire time. Otherwise, you get back and the customer didn't really have a quality test drive. They get back to the store. You ask them if you have any questions. Do you want to drive anything else? Are you comparing us to anything else? And do a product comparison with the competition. They're driving an F-150. They're looking at a Toyota. They're looking at a Chevy, Dodge. I'll point out some things we have that they don't.
I like that part about being quiet. I think the tendency might be to run your mouth and...
Yeah, you're interviewing somebody to be a salesperson. What's your best quality? Oh, I love to talk. Oh, okay. Do you like to listen?
I'm just going to comment when you're interviewing salespeople. I always like to ask, who's the best salesperson you know? If they don't answer themselves, next. Right?
Yeah, it's true. We've tried lately to get salespeople that aren't really salespeople. I don't know if you know what I mean by that. People from the service industry, waiters, waitresses, make fantastic salespeople because they know how to serve a customer. And that's important. What does the customer want? What does the customer need? Yep. I'll teach you how to sell the car. I'll teach you how to present the car. I'll teach you how to write it up and all that stuff. But if you don't have that smiling person right off the bat, then you're wasting your time. And my father's always told me, don't ever hire somebody that you wouldn't have over for dinner. And that's great advice. And the last few years, I've looked at people who've let go, and I'm like, yeah, I would never have them over in my house.
Salesmen are in a mode of service versus a mode of sales. Because if you're serving the customer, you find out what's important to them about the transaction, and then communicate that you care, then you create that. Then you're going to sell everyone that person knows a vehicle. You're just not selling that person that walks on the lot a vehicle. You become that go-to person. Hey, you got to go see my guy or gal. They're the best.
Mm-hmm. But the issue we're having is some of the younger people that get in this business tend to jump out of the business. So we're having to deal with reduced hours, non-commissioned pay plans. The industry's in a transition where the old dog, the old guard, the car guy isn't there anymore. You know, we have a couple of them. One just rotated into service and we got one left. And, you know, when he retires, it's that old guard's gone. You know, that old salesman is gone. They're really good. Their customers love them. They know what they're doing. And when he's with the customer, I don't have to worry. I know he's not going to, you know, say anything wrong. But unfortunately, they're retiring. They're getting older. And as we replace them with the younger people, they have a different mentality, and they tend to jump jobs, three and four jobs here and there. So I'm looking at resumes, I see that they're jumping around. But if they're personable and we give them a shot, we'll try to see if we can hang on to them with a good pay plan, with good work hours, good environment, and if they like it. So it's in a transition, so it'll be interesting to see how it works out in the next few years.
You've got a salesman named Scott that was reading. I was just reading reviews of the dealership, and his name just kept coming up in the reviews. What makes him such a good salesperson?
Scott has been with me for a few years now, and he does care for his customers. He's very personable, and he came from the service industry. He was an old waiter, and he knows how to serve people. So Scott does a great job with that. And he is my salesman of the year last year, or not last year, he lost last year, but he won the year before. He does do a good job with customers, and he does have a lot of repeat customers. So when you have repeat customers, they will fill out the reviews a lot of times. So he's got the longevity that a lot of the other people don't have.
I bet
he must be proactive about getting the reviews too, because right, like he's got to ask for it, right?
Yeah, he's got to ask for it. And the win salesman of the month, we have a board in here. We call it a salesman of the month board, and each one has a column. You know, how many new cars did you sell? How many used cars did you sell? How much finance did you do? How many reviews did you get? Is a column on the board.
Wow.
And so when the board at the end, it's like golf, you have to have a low number. When you get a low number, you have to be ranked high in each column. You can't just come out here and sell 20 new cars and then call it a day. You have to sell new, you have to sell used, you have to do F&I, you have to have reviews. So if he gets towards the top at all of them, doesn't do any reviews, then it's a dinger at the end. So his ranking will drop at the end. So you have to do a balanced job, and we do throw reviews into that formula because it's important to us. It's just as important as selling a new car. They work.
Yeah.
And we bonus them at the end of the month. You know, the sales in the month, number 1, 2, and 3 get a bonus and over and above what they've made. So it's important. At the end of the year, the salesman here gets a nice amount of chunk of money to go towards a vacation. We bonus them a week's vacation and we pay them to take it. And they can't take it and put it in the bank. They have to actually take their family or go and do something. So that's been successful for us for years.
Do you track self-reported attribution?
No, I don't. I'm not sure what that is.
Have people heard about you and have a system for basic for collecting responses to the idea of how did you hear about us?
No, I don't track that. We've done some surveys in the past on radios, you know, and that's kind of old school. You know, a lot of times when a customer comes in on a vehicle, I'll go up and I don't track it, but I do talk about it. Like if I, the other day there was 3 vehicles out there and I lowered all 3 1%. And a day later, somebody came in and bought one. So I'll walk over and say, hey, where'd you see us? Did you see us? Because I knew they saw it online. They didn't just happen to come in and land on that one vehicle that I reduced the night before. They bought it for a reason. So I talked to them and said, did you see us online? Where'd you see us? And the old school way is we would have a piece of paper at the sales tower. And every time we appraised a car, we would turn on the radio and see what radio station they were listening to. And that worked. I mean, that really worked. We had one radio station just crushing everybody in town. Unfortunately, now when you go in the cars, you'll see people hook up their phones and they've got Spotify, Pandora, podcast, you know, book on tape or whatever, Sirius Radio. There's so many different avenues in a car. We can't really do that anymore. But I'll still, when I'm appraising the car, we'll glance at the radio to see what you're listening to.
What do you say is your biggest challenge right now?
Oh, geez. You know, the biggest challenge had been inventory for the last few years. Last year, especially when the market was hot, I didn't have the inventory I needed with all my brands, my Ford and Mazda brands to sell what we needed to sell. So we lost business because the manufacturers didn't support us, and that hurt. And we were begging them. I would ask, you know, I would get 30 new Fords allocated to us. I'd ask for 30 more, and we'd get 1 or 2 extra, and that hurt. And so this year now, everybody's begging us to take inventory. The market's kind of flipped. Now it's the buyer's market. You see the discounts are back. We're back to 2019 real fast. It happened fast. And as interest rates have gone up, the market's flipped. And people are spending a lot of money at the grocery stores. The utilities are higher. Everything's higher. So the car market's really competitive again. So we're trying to make sure we're competitive online. The numbers are right. And then when the customers are coming in, we've got more inventory now than we have. Our floor plan's costing us more, so it behooves us to turn it fast. So that's the most concern I have top of mind is getting people on the lot. So I sit in front of my computer every day. I try to manage my inventory to get people here. I try to manage the advertising sources to drive traffic to the lot. Clicks are important, but if they don't come here, it's meaningless.
I know you're highly successful getting the written reviews. Have you been successful getting video testimials? Or
not yet. It's something I need my customers or my salespeople to push. We have the cards downstairs where they run the QR code, and then they can do it on their phones. We've pushed lately. You know, we were doing Dealer Raider for a while, and unfortunately, a lot of people don't really know that venue. So we really switched to Google. We want our Google reviews to be higher. We were the Dealer Raider dealer here multiple years, and we brag about that. But customers don't really know what that is. Google and Facebook are our top two. They have a Gmail account, we push the Google review. If they don't, and then they have a Facebook page, we push that. If they don't have Facebook or Gmail, then we go to Dealer Raider, and we try to do that.
What about photos at delivery? We call those photo endorsements.
You know, a lot of my people do that, and they take photos of them, and they put it on their personal Facebook pages, and they congratulate the customers they're selling. And that's what I need to figure out how to translate that photo into the review. So they're taking the pictures. So we just need to move them to the app and maybe send it to the customer and say, here's your photo at delivery. Can you do a review and have that photo be used in a review?
The trick is getting that customer to share it on their social media, because if they share it on their social media, it's even more valuable than a review, because now their network of friends and family are seeing you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we need to work on. That's definitely an opportunity for us. And the salespeople should buy in because it helps them get more referrals, and then something we could push our referral program at the same time.
Now, with Google reviews, you can put a photo, and we're starting to see the ability to leave videos on reviews.
Oh, okay.
So it's brand new, and it's very random on which listings you will see the video. And then sometimes it's hard to upload a video. So I think it's so new, but I think Google's moving in that direction to where when you leave a Google review, you can add a video to it, which would be cool.
Yeah, that would be neat. Yeah. It's going to be a salesperson having the knowledge on how to do it, and then the customer having the knowledge on how to do it as well. So got some training, some opportunity and training there.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. But yeah, it'd be great to have customers still sort. We have some shy customers that won't want to do it. I understand. So it's something we'd like to give a shot.
Yeah, we consider video the holy grail of testimonials. They're the hardest to get for sure, but there's nothing that communicates trust quite like the video. Have you heard about these companies selling Google reviews?
No.
It's unbelievable. You can actually buy Google reviews, and there's companies out there that are selling Google reviews to companies, and Google is doing nothing about it. I think it's absolutely insane that Google is allowing those sites. I mean, think about it. Google could blacklist those sites and take them off search results, and they're not doing it.
So, no, I've never heard of that. Luckily, I've never heard of that. I don't have to worry about that. I want my reviews to be legit. I want them to be local people. When you click on that, that's one thing I do when I'm responding to it. I click on it to see if that customer is local, because I've gotten reviews that were one stars for Champion Ford in a different state, because Champion Ford, there's more than one, and we're not affiliated with the one in Pennsylvania or the one in North Carolina. But the one in Pennsylvania made a few people mad a couple years ago because I was getting reviews for them. And luckily, I did find somebody at Google to take them down, because I said, look, this is not for my store. And once you prove it to them, that customer is out of my market, and I can also prove they've never been to my dealership through my DMS, that the review is for a different dealership, Google will respond and take those down. Luckily, I didn't have too many of them. But, yeah, it's unfortunate. And one thing that bothered me, and I think we talked about this last week, is Facebook reviews. Because these fake spam comments on my reviews – you look great, I would like to be your friend. And it's just a hassle. I get 5 to 6 a day on reviews. I have to go in and report for spam. Because on Facebook, I can't delete reviews again, just like Google. Right. I can't even delete comments on a review. So
they're crypto, they're Forex, they're investing, they're just BS. Have you seen Facebook removing them? Because we have a hard time with challenges.
Not many. I mean, they'll actually go on and give my dealership a review, a 5-star review, and then when they do it, it has nothing to do with the dealership. It just talks about buying crypto and all this stuff.
Right.
And then I went to Facebook, and it doesn't go anywhere. It just stays there.
Clearly spam.
Customers see that, and they've got to be like, what is that? There's nothing I can do about it. But Facebook needs to get off their butts and fix that. It's a mess, and it takes a lot of time to report those every single day. And if they don't take them off, then why report them? So fix that. And I don't know anybody. Of course, nobody knows anybody at Facebook or Google. So, Google doesn't have that problem because you really can't.
Well, Google has become more responsive since COVID. Like, we used to have a very difficult time getting mistaken identity reviews removed. Same, written for another Champion Ford. Since COVID, Google is much more likely to remove reviews that are mistaken identity or even unfair to the business. Used to, they didn't care. They operated much like Facebook. Facebook still doesn't care. And I think that at some point it's going to cost Mark Zuckerberg revenue, because companies are going to say, listen, I'm not going to do business with you. I'm not going to buy ads on your platform anymore because you're ignoring the customer. They just don't care.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate, actually. Have you Facebook Marketplace just as a free place to list cars? So I have a friend who she sells high-end $5,000 doors, custom doors, and a lot of her customers are home builders, and she has started listing her doors on Facebook Marketplace, not paying anything to Facebook, and she is just, they're flying out of her warehouse. And she was totally surprised. You would not think.
Yeah, the rules changed for automotive, Jesse.
So you can't put cars on there now.
Rules did change for automotive on Facebook, where now a dealer can't list vehicles on Marketplace, but individuals can. So figure that one out. Facebook has got some issues as well. And also, Facebook used to let us, as a dealership, I traded for a Lincoln MKX. This is years ago, before the Nautilus, and it was white, pearl white with tan leather, 30,000 miles. It was the A car, the perfect trade-in, 2 years old. And I said, okay, I know exactly who's going to buy this vehicle. It's going to be a female over 50. I'm going to market this vehicle with an ad. And it was just a picture of the vehicle, price, mileage, description. And I put out a picture. And then Facebook at this time would let me say, okay, I'm going to spend $75 to within 25 miles of my dealership. And I want everybody who's female over 50 to see this vehicle. Boom. Publish. Publish that. And then and in 2 days, I spent $27 and it sold to a female over 50 years old. You know, that was perfect rifle marketing that Facebook let me do. You can't do that now. Every right. dealer who advertises inventory has to hit special ad category for credit. And then Facebook picks the audience, not yeah. the dealership.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's so they can make more money. They show my $100,000 Roush F-250 to an 18-year-old kid because he's going to click on it. And they get paid, and I don't sell the vehicle. So I get it. So that's what we started doing with Facebook. We quit spending money.
Yeah. Good.
So
good.
At the end of the day, they lost money from us.
Yep.
I spend a little bit here on our normal ad just to have people see it. But that customer that I would have been spending money on individually to market a specific unit to a specific customer, I don't do that anymore. And it was so successful, it worked, so they stopped it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, attribution with Meta is a hellscape, honestly. And looking at what they say, everyone's trying to take credit for the same sale. I get that. But they have phantom numbers that are just totally unbelievable in terms of how much conversion value they're driving. And it's just hard to trust.
But they will listen to us and they will sell your data. Let me tell you something crazy that happened to me on Sunday. I had a flat tire. I pulled over. So I made a call first to roadside assistance. And I might have looked up a wrecker service because I couldn't get my lug nuts off my car. They were so tight. I was so mad. And believe it or not, this is the craziest thing. Within 10 minutes of me being on the side of the road, I get a text message from Pep Boys trying to sell me four tires. Free installation.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Wow.
I'm like, I haven't done business. I haven't walked into a Pep Boys in 20 years. I go to AutoZone or I go to another one, but I have no damn autos, but I have not walked into a Pep Boys. And I'm like, how did they do that? Is that not
weird? Wait, so give me the flow again. I'm trying to figure out where they.
Within 10 minutes of me being on the side of the road with a flat tire, I either did a Google search. I got to look back at my history, but I know I called roadside assistance. I know they're not listening to them on my phone, but maybe I did a Google search. But I'm talking. I came up and was trying to help me. Me and this guy are talking for 10 minutes trying to figure out how to get these lug nuts off. We could not get the lug. I couldn't break one seal on the lug nuts. It was crazy. I was literally standing on the tool, Duke, and I stripped one of the lug nuts.
Oh, wow.
So when roadside assistance got there, he got five bolts off, and then he couldn't get the – he had to use a special tool to get that sixth one off. It was crazy. But that is so bizarre that I get a text message from Pep Boys. I'm like, how did they know that I'm in the market?
Yeah.
I listen to the Glenn Beck podcast every now and then, and he recently has been on this technology rant about stuff like that. And he says, you know, for customers like us, we need to own our own data where I can be – I'm the product for Facebook because they sell me, and I get on there. It's free because they sell me. And Instagram, same. I see the ads, and I buy stuff. But I need to own my own data, so they need to be paying me to be able to sell my data. Otherwise, they can't sell it to anybody. And Congress would do that. It would change everything in this country as far as social media and advertising, because I'm a pretty good customer and I'd probably rate a pretty high value.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to buy stuff, they're selling my data. I get no benefit for it at all.
Right.
So I like that idea from Mr. Beck. I need to try to figure out how to make that happen.
I wouldn't hold your breath.
That's true.
I don't think any checks from Facebook are in the mail right now. But
we've all seen the photo, the famous photo of Mark Zuckerberg with his computer with the microphone taped up and the camera taped up. And if he can't block it on his computer, who can? Right?
Yeah. No, it's the biggest problem is this right here.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
Always with you.
I've got my little thing up here that allows me to shut the. I do have that.
Oh. Because well, mine's an add-on. So when I get off here, it turns off. It's never on. So
last week when I'm working on my PowerPoint, my light kept turning on. And I'm like, why is the camera turned on when I'm on PowerPoint?
I've had that crap happen to me too, where the green light comes on and I'm thinking, why is my camera recording right now? And there's no applications open.
No.
And I feel like it's just some app or something that I've downloaded. And it's like, yeah, it's just watching me and reporting back to the data overlords. Yeah, it's crazy. Creepy.
Well, one last question for Duke. Duke, I always ask this question, and I want to, what do you want to be known for?
Wow, that's a good question. What do you want to be known for, personally or professionally?
Both.
Both? Well, personally, you know, be a good family guy. To be there for my family is number one and first and foremost. And that's why we do everything we do every day. So you can't see over my shoulder, my boy's picture's back here, my wife's picture's back here, and that's why I come here every day, take care of them. Professionally, to be fair, honest, work hard worker, to be fair not only for my customers, but my employees. I take back a lot of things my father's kind of taught me well, is about taking care of employees, having them over for dinner. You don't hire them if you wouldn't have them over your house. You know, unfair pay plan will change one way or the other. But if I'm paying too much to somebody, then it's going to be unfair for the dealership. It will change. If I'm paying not enough, it'll be unfair for the employee. They will leave. So you got to make sure that you have a fair pay plan for everybody that's fair for the store and the employee. And it would be fair. It would be known for that. Be a good operator, successful operator. It's something, you know, we benchmark against the 20 group, and I see dealers that sometimes aren't the best operator that we are, but they make a lot more money, and it upsets me. And it's like, well, how can they do that? And we can't. So I dive into metrics and I see some of the reasons why, and I disagree with that. So I just have to move on. And, you know, you operate at the end of the day with what you're taught, and you try to be fair and foremost and happy in life. That's kind of important.
That's awesome.
That's great. Yeah, well, thank you for your time today. It was really nice getting a chance to speak with you and some really interesting insights you had. I guess last thing is, where can people find you if they want to talk to you or have a second to plug your
dealership? Well, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, or X as they call it now, and I'm easy to find. It's Duke Brew, D-U-K-E-B-R-U on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn, never look at it, probably should, but it's just too much trash on there, too much sensory overload. I have to limit my stuff. On Facebook is Duke Brewbaker. That's easy. Champion Ford is championowensboro.com, and, you know, we want to try to get our name out there and sell some cars. Actually, I have to stop saying that. We don't want to sell cars because we don't have cars anymore. Sell some vehicles. How about that?
That's right, that's right.
We have a Mazda 3 and a Ford Mustang. Those are the only cars we have. So no longer sell cars. Sell vehicles. I got to stop that. The car guys always say, I'm a car guy. I'm a vehicle guy, I guess.
You're a vehicle guy now.
Oh, that shit sucks. But, you know, we started on them canceling vehicles we love. The Ford Fusion was just a great vehicle. We loved it. It's gone. We have a meeting in Las Vegas in August. Hopefully Ford's got some dynamic new stuff for us, but I'm afraid that we're not going to see anything. So
nobody's buying cars anymore. It's so weird. They're all converted to the SUVs and the crossovers, and yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, people love those, but sometimes people want cars. People want minivans. Mm-hmm. Ford doesn't make either anymore.
Wow.
And we just give that business to the imports. They all have minivans. They all have cars. The
mm-hmm.
Ford's still made. The Camry's still made. Sienna, that stuff's out there. And we're not getting any of that business. So they may have an F-150 in their driveway, but their wife's driving a Toyota Sienna. And mm-hmm. you know, maybe next time the guy buys a Tundra. So it's something that Ford needs to really get their act together and maybe bring a nice car back out. They can make one. They did it in the past. I mean, look at the history and the value of the Escort, the Taurus, the Fusion, the Prius. You know, they've had some hiccups here and there, but
Taurus,
they do
that's
it.
Taurus SHO. Man, that was a cool
the
car.
The show was a fantastic mm-hmm. vehicle for the age, and it just got
oh
better.
My God.
Best
yep.
car they ever made, you know. So they can do it. They have to have the will to do it, you know. And unfortunately, sometimes they want to make a $300,000 race car that none of us can be able to sell instead of a Fusion again.
That's right.
And, you know, Mr. Farley up there loves those race cars. They're very, very cool, but I can't sell it. And,
mm-hmm.
and I won't get one. And most dealers won't get one. When a customer has to apply to get a vehicle from Ford, that's a problem.
Is that a Ford GT? What is it?
No, the Ford GTD, the new Mustang that's coming out.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a $300,000 Mustang. You know, it's a race car. It's a street legal race car. They're doing it to race at Le Mans or wherever they're going to race. I don't know. So that's great. They race on Sunday, still on Monday. to win on Sunday. But I watched the Indy 500 last weekend. There wasn't a Ford in that field. It was all Honda and Chevy.
Wow.
So they don't care about Indy, but they care about Le Mans, which most Americans don't watch.
Right.
Yeah. I'd like to have a Fusion. I'd like to have some vehicles we can sell on the ground, you know, bring back the Excursion on the Super Duty chassis. If you don't want to make many because of global warming and what they all believe in up north, only make 10,000 of them or 20,000 of them.
Yeah.
But it would sell because I see them in my service department. I try to buy them and they go, oh, no, I'm not getting rid of this. Not getting rid of this.
Excursion.
The values are ridiculous on those Excursions. Yeah. And they thought that people would buy the extended length Expedition, but buyer's not buying that. So
why not?
The other products they could make and be successful if they would just do it.
Mm-hmm. There's a market there for sure.
Yep.
Cool. Thanks again.
Well, Duke, sir, really appreciate your time and great conversation, great insights. Love some of the things you shared with us today. That salesman of the month thing, that is really cool how you did. I mean, most dealerships just do it on pure sales. And the fact that you're taking different areas and combining those, I love that. That's cool.
Yeah, we've been doing that for quite a long time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's neat. That's very cool.
Thank you.
Well, Duke, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here, Duke. All right.